position number 11748, reel 11.
Colonel Ismail, reel 11. So there he gave us the news about these bombs, which we didn't know it was an atomic bomb and what was a nuclear bomb. So we then, he said, you always give us exaggerated news. So he took it with a pinch of salt. But then towards the evening, I was walking along the barbed wire on the Sarita Road, outside the Sarita camp, when a Chinaman was sidling up and was giving me thumbs up all the time, gleefully. Then a South Indian coolie was also cycling up after that, and he began to wave his arms. So I suspected that something must have been happening outside. So I came back and we sat and told my friends and we discussed it the whole night. Next morning I was very hungry, so I told my orderly and three of us were messing together. Previously we used to mess, all officers, we used to get together, about 14, 15 of us, and eat together, and our orderlies used to cook our rations, which contained then 6 ounces of rice and 4 ounces of vegetables, which we used to grow in our own little patches individually. And Japs will come and leave us 4 ounces and take the rest away every day. And they would watch if we had taken away all the vegetables or most of it, a little. They had an uncanny sense of finding out that we have taken more. Then they immediately used to threaten us with theft. So by then our rations are reduced, 4 ounces of vegetables, green spinach, which we grew and grew from seeds, which was getting quite coarse by then, and 6 ounces of rice, which is to boil. And then we used to buy this green millet, the jolly old Indian dal, and 2 ounces of that we used to cook for ourselves each. And that was then, by then the price had got up to 300 pounds, 300 straight dollars a pound, as opposed to our $40 a month pay. But by then we were selling whatever we had, socks and watches and pens and anything we had, we were selling, even down to our blankets we sold, to buy a pound of dal apiece, and then our orderly used to cook 2 ounces per head. So Daddy insisted we should eat 4 ounces per head today. So we got together. My orderly shook his head, but I said, let's eat today. I think the war is over. And I'd given myself an extra shave that day with my cutthroat razor, give a twist to my moustaches, and in my G-strings, I was sitting there outside my hut, our hut, when a plane came. A plane came flying over Singapore, and AK guns were shooting at it. So all my friends turned around and began to cuss me around drums, that here's your end of the war. There you are. It's an Allied plane, the Japs are shooting at it. But then somebody said, look, the bombs are exploding not in front of the plane, when the plane is paused behind its tail. There's bad shooting, but Japs are capable of doing a pretty good shooting. No, that's a hoax. And next day after this, again I was sitting watching the skies, when a P-38 American fighter turned up with 2 fuselages. P-38. There was a delightful sight. Absolutely. Officers were sitting there receiving it with mute jubilation, while men away from us in their barracks, they were cheering wildly. And then the whole thing went quiet. By the evening, a Japanese general turned up and said that, called our senior officer out, he said, the war is finished, and we should sit tight in our camps, not to go out, and maintain our discipline. But the war is over. And then the British officers came, the day or two, as I mentioned before. And the British officers came, and they were settling in, and the Japanese pouring rations into us. rations which we never saw for 3.5 years, which was the rations which were dumped by, which was in dumps for the long siege of Singapore, suddenly appeared, like tins of meat and vegetable, Irish stew, bully beef, and stacks of butter, tins of salmon, and things like that. And we were given it ad lib. And each officer received a carton of caps and cigarettes. So we were really having a ball. Then I was hanging out the camp one day, at the same time, when I saw a tall, beefy chap walk up to me with a red beret and an olive green uniform, which I'd never seen before, olive green, and kind of a grayish, olivish, spat-like things, like leggings, and rubber-soled ammunition boots, and with a funny-looking gun, a kind of submachine gun, which later I discovered it was a Sten gun, hanging over his shoulder, and a grenade around his waist. And he came striding up towards me, he said, "Hey, you!" I looked at him, saw his two pips, and here I just realized, my God, he's just a lieutenant, and I've got about over 5 years' service, and why should he say, "Hey, you," to me? So I walked up to him and said, "Yes." He said, "Where's the senior Jap Wala?" Now, the Urdu word, which points to your trade, is Wala. So he said, "Who is your senior Jap Wala?" So I thought, obviously, that's Colonel Julian de Wilton. So I said, "Well, he's there, Colonel Julian de Wilton." So I took him to Colonel Julian de Wilton. I said, "Sir, he's looking for a senior Jap Wala." Colonel de Wilton, being Indian cavalry, he knew Urdu. And his face was impassive. He was very wrinkled, gaunt. Very handsome, tall, very dignified man he was. I remember him to this day. He looked at him, "Yes. What can I do for you?" And there he was. This chap began to rattle off. So later they collected all the officers, British and Indian officers, to listen to him give us instructions. At that time I was so disgusted, as I refused to go sit with that thing when he would be talking, that young fella. I'm not. So I walked away. Later I discovered that he gave a talk punctuated with threats, which was reminiscent of the Japanese talks to us, that if you do this, if you do that, you'll be called martial. If you left the camps, you'll be called martial. If we went up and try to threaten the Japs or beat him up, we'll be called marshaled. And we are responsible for the discipline of our men. They should be kept in check, and so on and so forth.
Was he a parachuter?
Parachuter, obviously a parachuter. So he came and stood there, and then he said, "Nobody will leave their camps. Absolutely. These orders are straight from Louis Mountbatten." I wasn't there, but I heard later that a British major from the medical services stood up. He addressed him as "my boy," and he said that he was a prisoner for 3.5 years. His wife is in a civil internee camp. He hasn't seen his wife for 3.5 years. He doesn't know her fate, and she doesn't know of his fate. Is Mountbatten can go and do something to himself. He is not going to adhere to this, and the first opportunity he gets, he's going to walk out, go and search for his wife. And he said, "Nobody can stop him." And I believe this young fellow was a bit shaken, but he ignored him. He had given his thing, he walked away. Later in the evening, I saw for the first time a jeep, which I'd never seen before. Our smallest army vehicle, which officers used to use, was a 1500-weight truck or a station wagon used by commanding officers and the brigade commander. This funny-looking thing, with windshield down on the bonnet, and nothing on top, and this kind of a thing, and two women were driving it. And they drove to the camp. For the first time, he saw women in olive green, dressed up. They were obviously, what they call them, vekais or something like that. So the first reaction was to run up to them and just engage them in conversation. But then I thought the better of it, and I hung around with my little water hubble bubble pipe, which I made for myself, smoking it. The first thing of my experience of seeing a Jeep. Then afterwards, two Indian officers walked in. I saw black pips on one shoulders and a red thing underneath the pips, cloth pips.
What did the black pips signify?
Baruch Regiment or Friendly Force Regiment. When he came up, the regimental markings were away. I mean, were off his shoulders for security reason. So he came to me and he said, he's Shah Nawaz. I said, what is your regiment? He said, Baruch. I said, good, I'm Baruch too. I said, I was second Baruch. He said, he knew it. Where are they? I said, they are in a different camp, down in Alexander camp, and we were here as officers separated from them. So I asked him, how much service has he got? So he told me that he had 3 years service. So when I looked at him, he shyly laughed. He said, well, I believe you're senior than, I was senior than him. I said, oh, yes, I was commissioned in 1940. So that was my first exchanges with free officers who have fought a war, and by stages, and some had fought in Middle East and Italy, and then Burma, and then they arrived there. Very exhilarating sight, very exhilarating sight. Anyhow, that done, then we heard that our battalion was concentrated in a camp called Buller Camp. No, Alexander Camp. So we got down, we were supposed to go up and join our battalion there. And there I found my CO, Colonel John Frith. Very fine soldier, thorough gentleman. And then our previously adjutant, then sent command before the fall of Singapore. He was there. So I joined them in that camp. So as we had joined and we were immediately getting our nominal roles for our men and things like that, I was walking up in the camp and I saw another Jeep with a young British subaltern sitting in it, in olive green. So he stopped the Jeep and we said hello to each other. I said, what was his regiment? He's the 2nd 1st Punjab Regiment. I said, oh. When he saw that I was an Indian officer, he said, well, their CO is an Indian officer. Now, just before the Japanese surrender, Lieutenant Colonel Bonsley, I mentioned earlier on, he had joined us, commanding the Garhwal Regiment. And then as a prisoner, as we became prisoners, I saw Lieutenant Colonel Narinjan Singh Gill, the Sikh officer, as a Lieutenant Colonel. And when he said another Lieutenant Colonel, a Sikh officer, who was commanding them, was an Indian, I was quite pleased about it. And he said, he's a great soldier, you know, he had a DSO and an MC. And they had fought on with the 8th Army in Libya and Alexander and Al-Amin. Then they had fought in Italy, and then they came and fought in Burma, and then they came to Singapore. They were ready to fight in Singapore, but the Japanese had surrendered after the Hiroshima bomb. So I said, have you got any other officers, Indian officers with you? So he took the name of him, of an officer called Niaz Arbab. I said, good God, he was my class fellow at college. So he offered, would I like to see him? I said, very much. So he said, hop in the Jeep. So I jumped into the Jeep. I forgot the discipline that I should go in and ask my CO or my adjutant. So I jumped in the Jeep and he took me off through Singapore, towards Bukit Timah Road, where most of the fighting had taken place. And then he took me up a little windy road to a marvelous villa on high ground, where the officers of the 21st Punjab, they were penetrated there. So as he took me, we went in, and there was a terrific party going on. The officers had given a party for the Viceroy commissioned officers. As he took me in the room, it was a terrific sight. Oh, it was such a pleasant sight, because after being a prisoner of war for 3.5 years, as I went in, the hum of the conversation, drinks being served, smoke-filled room, absolute sheer delight. So he walked me up to his colonel first, he said, and I introduced myself to him, and the colonel was a great, great soldier, DSO and MC, and a fine, fine caliber man. Young, much younger than today you can find lieutenant colonels. So I asked him if he knew my elder brother, who was in the army. When I said Yusuf, he said, good heavens, they were both course mates at the Indian Military Academy. And I said, is he dead or alive? Have you heard about him? He said, yes, yes, he's perfectly all right. Last he saw him was in 1943. And he had some heart trouble. He was invalided out of the army, and he had gone to the Indian Political Service. But he was all right. Then I asked him about my younger brother, I had heard that he was a fighter pilot. And he said he had heard about him, but he doesn't know where was he then. But he was a fighter pilot flying in Burma. Then I met Arbab Niaz. Then they insisted I should sit to dinner with him. And when he asked me, what would I have to drink? I said, may I have some neat whiskey? I've never tasted whiskey in years. And they were drinking, funny enough, Canadian bourbon. But I'd forgotten the taste of whiskey, so to me, bourbon was whiskey. One drink led to the other, and the other officers crowded around me with my turned-up Kaiser-like moustaches, which I developed as a prisoner of war, and my rather unshapely bush shirt, which was patched, my shorts, which were frayed at the end, no stockings, no hose tops, just my grey army socks turned down, all my chaplis, the front of chaplis. I made a strange sight to these olive green clad officers and men with their ribbons galore on their chests. Military crosses among the Viceroy Commission officers were not rare either. They had military crosses even. And 8th Army. I was fascinated. But I'd forgotten all my 3.5 years just in a jiffy. I was back into form. Conversations floating. I gave them anecdotes about the Japanese, made it as funny as I possibly could. Then I began to talk about the Indian National Army, and they were all led by the Sikhs, of the officers of the whole Indian Army. And I turned on to the CO, who made me sit next to him. I said, with due apologies to him, he said, don't apologize to me for the bloody Sikhs. They always do the most odd things. And he was very sporting about it. Then when we left the mess lunette, they gave me 4 bottles of Canadian bourbon and a sack full of bottles of beer. He said, take it and give it to your friends there. So we got in the jeep, and by then Arbab Niaz Muhammad, my old college mate, drove me. On the Bukit Timah Road, I saw a column of Japanese being marched to a prisoner of war camp. I begged Niaz, I said, Niaz, stop your jeep, let me speak to them. There was the day I was waiting for. So he stopped the jeep, I stood in the jeep and bellowed a word of command in Japanese to halt. And they halted. Then I said, attention. Then I said, stand at ease. The words of command, James, are different, but I remember them then. For example, for stand at ease was Yasumi. And I kept on standing at my ease and coming into attention. Then I made them double. Then I made them turn about. Then again they doubled. And by then, the thing was getting beyond a joke. My voice was absolutely on top of the world. Al-Bab Niaz Muhammad told me, he said, look, old boy, don't let him be court martialed. Stop it now. So he stopped it. And then I said, look, before you take me to the camp, I want to go to the civil internees camp, where the women's section is, to see that poor old girl, a poor girl called Patsy, which whom I mentioned earlier on, and who, due to my, this thing, friendship with her, the Japanese, she must have come to, I think, by the Japanese Kempotai. So he drove me there. So I went up, and the first barrack of the women I went in, all the women were sitting down. Mostly they were Eurasians from Singapore and Malaya Island. Eurasians were whose parents were British. And one parent was British, the other parent was local. So they were enemy aliens, so they were put in the camp. So the first one looked at us, and they were all excited to see us two walking in. And I said, I took the name of the girl, I would not like to mention it here, because you see, somehow she might hear it, or her husband. So I said, where is she? So they said, well, she's gone out. Gone out with a boyfriend who had come and seen her, and they had gone out. So I asked him, I said, was her boyfriend a Dutchman? He said, yes, Dutch. So I was relieved and happy about it, that she had told me that it was her boyfriend who was since 1938, and that due to the surrender, she had lost contact with him. And then if he was around, I was very pleased that they got together. So I said, all right, when she comes back, to give her my love, and to tell her that I came in to, you know, ask about her. And I said, I didn't know where would I be the next few days, so I didn't leave any address around there. So I walked out. Later I discovered from my relative that they got together, and he married her and took her away to Holland, which is a very good news. Because I don't think the Japanese were pretty harsh on her, because the only thing they could do was to put her back into the camp. And as I said, I planned with her that she should say that I belong to the INA. Under that impression, she was meeting me, not for any other reason. So that was one thing good that happened. Second, my relative got away. So I came back to the camp. Another British officers from other regiments were there. And I appeared with a sack load of beer over my shoulders and four bottles of beer, and I arrived. My poor Audrey was waiting for me. When I arrived, pretty high, lit up, as they said. They said, what have you brought? So I emptied the sack of beer. Much to the disgust of Peter Campbell, he said, look, all these chaps are very selfish. They would never have shared theirs with me. Why was I doing this? But the die was cast, and everybody jumped about it. And we had a great party the whole night. Next morning, the whiskey was finished, the beer was finished. So Peter Campbell announced that the ship which would be taking us back to India would be dry. So I panicked that we should try and get a drink there. So I was very dejectedly, rather hungover, walking up and down the barbed wire. But the Chinaman came and spoke to me. Chinese are always delightful. They came up and because they were anti-Japanese and they liked us very much. So I told him, he said, what could he do for me? I said, could he get me some local liquor even? There was a famous whiskey which they produced, out of Spill probably, called Non-Boku whiskey. So we used to make jokes about it. Don't be, as you say about John Haig whiskey, don't be vague, ask for John Haig. We used to say, don't be cuckoo, ask for Non-Boku. So I was expecting Non-Boku whiskey. But after about, he said, you'll come back in an hour. He turned up and bought me two bottles of unlabeled, completely unlabeled and sealed bottles, a very clear whiskey-looking bottles, liquor inside it. So I took those and I hid him, told my auntie to hide him in his kit bag. And that was the thing which we had in the ship with us. Anyhow, we gave our nominal roles and one thing or the other. But at that time, there were a lot of Indian National Army people who had joined the National Army and left and came and joined us. So the British officers said that they must have a parade, everybody to line up. And the announcement they read by British officers and by Indian officers, like Captain Durrani from my battalion, that anybody who had had even a single day's pay from the Indian National Army should step out. And our men knew who they were. So there was complete silence, and men began to step out. Because they knew the game was up, because somebody would tell on them. So they stepped out. And some officers, Viceroy Commission officers, went some little truck with the Japanese. I mean, they were not in it at all. But they said they had to go because they could have given them information about the others who were there. So they stepped out. And there was a Captain Jilani from 419 Hyderabad Regiment, very, very dear friend of mine, who had joined the Japanese during 1942 after surrender, much to my disgust. And he had come to see me one day in the concentration camp. I was digging my usual daily trench. And he had a major's rank on his shoulders. And he came and saw me. And he said he could get me to India. I shook my head and said, how? he said that keep it under the hat. He was running a fifth column school for the Japanese. And he convinced the Japanese that he run a fifth column school and the men would be taken to India by a submarine from Malaya through the Indian Ocean, round Sri Lanka, and up the coast of India to Baluchistan coast, a place called Pasni. Pasni or Poshni is Pasni, I think. There they be landed. And for ostensibly for sabotage and sending information back to the Japanese, but their order, they obviously they'll go immediately join the British and go back to families. He had recruited by then two Afridis, you know, tribesmen from the Khyber. One was a warrant officer in the station workshops. His name was a warrant officer Asal Noor. And the other young fellow was another Afridi, very fair skin, green eyes, short and very tough, muscular chap, called Mir Mast. He was also a warrant officer. And when I was taking a map reading test many, many months ago in 1941, middle 41, he was one of the chaps appearing for the map reading test. I remember from those days. Those two had joined Jilani, and another IMS doctor called Akbar Shah Pathan, another Pathan officer called Sanaullah. So he offered me to take me along